Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, and a man who has distinguished himself in many capacities, but notably of late, in the leadership of the House of Representatives, is our first guest. He is Congressman Pete Sessions. He represents the people of the 32nd District of Texas these days, and has been as chairman of the House Rules Committee. They call it the powerful House Rules Committee because it determines what goes to the floor. He has been instrumental in enacting any number of pieces of legislation, but notably recently, one near and dear to our hearts here at Secure Freedom Radio. And Congressman, I want to thank you right out of the box, both for joining us, of course, but also for your leadership on the recently passed, unanimously no less, passed Critical Infrastructure Protection Act in the House of Representatives. Thank you for that, and thank you for joining us.
Frank, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you. The people of Dallas, Texas, and surrounding areas recognize how important my work is, not only that I do on the Rules Committee, but even taking up pieces of legislation that you've talked about. And so it is in the best interest of, I believe, and you believe, our entire country to address these important issues. And I think that, as you know, over the last 10 years in particular, America has seen an unprecedented influx in electronic use that has transformed our economy. In the 80s, I was at the former Bell Labs organization in New Jersey.
One of the real pioneering operations at the time.
It was, and that ended up being from Bell Labs to Bell Communications Research when I was there. And we saw what the technology would do and alter literally everything we do. Unfortunately, our nation's electrical grid is also highly susceptible to natural and man-made bursts of energy known as you know, EMP, these electronic magnetic pulses. And these, because we live off this backbone, this infrastructure, and because of EMP, we have to look at this as something that could threaten our critical infrastructure. Last year...
And our society and our lives.
Absolutely. Right. Last year, however, four members of Congress, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, reported that Iran has been developing their cyber espionage attack capacities that could severely compromise us.
Even before the bit about the Chinese inside the grid, which is, of course, what you're referring to with Admiral Mike Rogers, but on your Iran point, we've had a report out of a group called Cylance saying the Iranian cyber warfare folks have been inside our electric grid control systems, among other things, for 2 years. So this is a present danger. Talk, if you would, very quickly about what the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act does and why you thought it important enough to put your name on it and get it through the House, and where we're going now in the Senate.
Sure. In fact, this young man, Trent Franks, and I, it's all Trent. I simply did my duty and my job to help. But we serve together. Trent's from Arizona. He's done a great job. He saw this as the threat it was. And so he came up with a legislation that really directs the Department of Homeland Security to understand the threat and to implement plans about how we can best protect and recover if this happened. Now, once again, what we're not playing to people's worst fears, Mr. Gaffney. We are preparing ourselves to avoid something that I believe is in our future.
Yeah. Well, as you say, especially the naturally occurring piece of this.
Absolutely. But we are so dependent now on this backbone, this infrastructure, that we've got to understand it. So we've really told them, and I'm not saying they should or shouldn't have done it on their own, but we've really told them from a policy perspective of the United States Congress, this is what we want you to do. Now we've got to get it to the Senate, and I think we'll get that done.
That's the big question, I guess, at the moment. Again, as the chairman of the Rules Committee, you have an ability, I think, probably to exercise some moral suasion, shall we say, on senators who want legislation through your body as well. I gather that Senator Ron Johnson, the incoming chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, the counterpart to the committee under Michael McCaul, as you know, that moved the SIPA legislation through, is very supportive of it. So we're really hoping that this will be an early action item in both houses under the new management next year.
Well, you know, we've seen people like Dick Cheney, former vice president, former speaker Newt Gingrich, people that come into contact and take time to look at this really recognize the danger. And this is where, Frank, your insight and really telling people things that they might not know and bringing this to their focus means so much. And Trent Franks and you have done an awesome job.
Thank you. Well, it is a team effort, and we're very pleased that you've played a leading role in it, Congressman Pete Sessions. Thank you again for that. Let me turn quickly, if I may, just to a couple of other things that I know that are on the minds of our listeners and ask your sort of sense of things. We have, of course, had the president recently act through executive action, as he calls it, on what I think is correctly described as amnesty. The House has passed one piece of legislation, the yo-yo bill, they call it, and is about to take up, I guess today, the budget for the next year, the funding bill. How is this likely to affect our ability to prevent, through executive action, this kind of amnesty, Congressman?
You know, thank you very much. First of all, I believe you did correctly tee it up, so to speak, Frank. The president's actions that he has done, we believe in the House of Representatives and certainly as Republicans that he has exceeded not only his authority, but he has unlawfully directed agencies to do things that he does not have the ability to do. His job is to well and faithfully execute the laws of the United States, not make them up as we go along. The president, by the way, evidently still has not signed that order.
Is that right?
I do not believe he has signed the order, but we're moving forward in the House to find our options. As you know, Frank, today is December the 10th, and we have not taken over the Senate yet. That happened in the election a month ago, but we do that on January the 5th. And until January the 5th, we are in the same circumstance with Harry Reid, and Mr. Reid is not going to entertain any of these activities that to block this program. So here's where then this memo that came out from my dear friend Jeff Sessions from Alabama. Jeff Sessions wrote the Congressional Research Service and said, how do we look at what the president has done? And they came back and said, well, first of all, it is being paid for by fees from people who come into this country through the programs, and it's not an appropriated fund, which means that Congress does not appropriate it, and unless the House, the Senate, and the President agree, the President can keep using this money that comes in for fees, even if the government is shut down. So it was not clear from the Jeff Sessions memo. Yesterday, the CRS sent me a new memo, which we have up on our website, sessions.house.gov, which clarifies, oh, it can be done, but it would require the legal process of all two bodies and the president agreeing to it. So what it means is in the short term, the president is not in favor of this, would not take these actions. And so it would result in either us shutting down the government or, which is what I prefer, let's just wait till we get the Senate and then we'll address the issue this next year.
So we will have legislation coming out of your body that will fund the rest of the government but withhold funds for the Department of Homeland Security, which overall has this function.
You're correct. What we've said is we will fund the rest of the government through September 30th. 2015, but only for Department of Homeland Security until the middle of March, beginning of March. That allows the Senate the time to come in and for us to readdress the issue.
You'll be taking this up in earnest, and I trust that you will be in the lead, Congressman Pete Sessions, in terms of trying to ensure that this really is repudiated by both sides of the Hill. I must say, if I may, just in parting, Congressman, I'm concerned that in funding the rest of the government, though, you are tying your hands in terms of the power of the purse with respect to things like Gitmo and the EPA and, disposing of the Internet and who knows what else this president will do by fiat. It's a very vexing issue, and I know you're trying your best. I appreciate so much your taking the time to talk with us about it. We look forward to having a longer conversation with you, I hope, in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you again for your work on the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act.
Frank, thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners who care so much about the security of our great nation.
They do indeed. Thank you for joining us, Congressman. We'll talk with you soon.
You betcha.
Next up, a young Israeli paratrooper talks about a new film chronicling him and his colleagues in the front lines of the war for the free world. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time by a young man from Israel. He is a first lieutenant in the Israel Defense Forces by the name of Aviv Regev. He has achieved the rank of a deputy platoon commander in Israel's 101st Paratrooper Brigade. But much of note at the moment is that he is one of the stars of a new film, a documentary entitled Beneath the Helmet, From High School to the Home Front. He grew up in northern Israel, but spent several years in New Jersey. We're catching up with him in Philadelphia at the moment. He has graciously agreed to talk a little bit about the new film, which will premiere in the Washington area at the Jewish Community Center tomorrow on the 11th. Lieutenant, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Congratulations on your new role. Talk a little bit about this film, Beneath the Helmet. Who made it, and what's its major point?
Well, an organization called Jerusalem U, which is a nonprofit American organization that put its objective to educate about Israel through interactive film and media, just popped up on our base one day when I recruited 120 soldiers and started filming us for 8 months. And they were literally with us for the whole time during live fire exercises, when we were jumping out of planes. They were really able to capture the process that we teenagers in Israel go through in the army while we face all the challenges and difficulties and the harsh reality of Israel. So it's really a story about a coming of age, the strength of the human spirit. I think it also gives a lot of inspiration.
Our guest is Aviv Regev. He is a first lieutenant in the Israel Defense Forces, and we're talking with him about a new film in which he features prominently, Beneath the Helmet, From High School to the Home Front. And, Lieutenant, you were describing this as a coming-of-age story. Talk a little bit, if you will, about what that means as a practical matter for you and your comrades in arms, thrust as you have been in many cases, literally from, you know, high school into the front lines of Israel's fight for survival against an array of very hostile adversaries.
Well, for me, it's the responsibility. I can't speak for all soldiers in Israel, obviously, but I can tell you from my own experience that the responsibility that you suddenly gain in such a short amount of time is just unheard of and unprecedented. It's probably the only place in the world where at such a young age you have so much responsibility. And if it's at the age of 21, finding yourself literally commanding and providing for 40 soldiers, and at the age of 23 for 120 soldiers. And it's not just training, it's combat too. So that's quite a big responsibility.
It is indeed. You're literally on the line for their lives and well-being, as well as the performance of their mission. Talk a bit, if you would, for most Israelis, this is not a matter of volunteering for the military. This is something that is required as conscription. Is that not the case?
Right. So in Israel, we have what's called a national service. It's the law to be a part of it. For the boys, it's 3 mandatory years, and for the girls, it's 2 years. It's a bit more broader than just the army. It includes hospitals, police department, fire department, social welfare, and the army itself also, which most teenagers do go to. And once we do go into the army, it's by every definition of the word, it's considered the people's army. And that means that we have soldiers from the top 10% of society, from the bottom 10%, from big cities, small towns, Christians, Muslims, desert nomads, Druze and Jews alike, everyone in the same platoon. So it's quite the melting pot. And you could even say a ticket into the Israeli society to be a part of it.
And as a deputy platoon commander, of course, you've witnessed, I'm sure, some of the strains that go with those differences being melded, if you will, in that melting pot. How difficult was it as a young commander for you to have this kind of, well, as you say, responsibility, but also challenge? And what does it say about the larger Israeli society to which these conscripts will ultimately return?
So first of all, it really is quite a challenge. You find yourself investing all of your energy and all of your time in it. It was not once and not twice that I found myself on my vacations driving cross country, which is, it's not that big. It's like crossing New Jersey, but still with, you could even say with the washing machine to one of my soldiers' homes because they found out that he doesn't have a washing machine and they're living 9 family members. So some of the time you're even just focusing on the social welfare. You're not even sure if you're a combat officer or not because you're trying to provide for all the soldiers and make sure they have everything they need. And other times you find yourself very strained in combat operations and in very difficult training sessions, which are also pushing you to the extreme.
This, again, is Lieutenant Aviv Regev we're speaking to. He is one of the featured participants in a new documentary entitled Beneath the Helmet, From High School to the Home Front, which will be premiering in the Washington, D.C. area at the Jewish Community Center on the 11th of December. And let me just ask you, because you've obviously been confronting up close and personally, as they say, some of these adversaries. There are now reports that after the campaign in Gaza over the summer, the terrorists and jihadists of Hamas are once again putting together more rockets and missiles with which to attack Israel. How do you feel about what is in prospect now, so shortly after this bitterly fought campaign? And what do you think the people of Israel more broadly feel?
Honestly, the truth of the reality that we live in is that it's very frustrating. In Israel, we want to live our lives peacefully and quietly, but it feels like every few years we can't ignore anymore the threats around us, and we have to deal with them, and then they rearm, and then we have to deal with them again, and it's kind of a cycle, like mowing your lawn, you could even say. But it's very disturbing, especially with all the money they're receiving from different countries around the world. A lot of money that is going unsupervised. No one really can, after they give them money, no one really knows what they do with it.
Or worse, we actually have very strong reason to believe what they're doing with it is building more tunnels and building missiles and otherwise preparing for the next onslaught. And as you say, that there's a sort of idea here that this is something that just has to be done to maintain a sense of order in the neighborhood. But unfortunately, unlike the grass, this stuff is going to kill people unless it's stopped. And it must be, as you say, extraordinarily frustrating that Israel is endlessly halted from finishing the job in the face of these ongoing threats. Let me ask you about one thing that is now being bruited about in the United States. You've spent some time here, Lieutenant. Your English is flawless. I wondered what you thought, as a man with some experience with both countries, of the reported consideration being given by President Obama to putting sanctions on Israel over its construction of so-called settlements.
Well, first of all, we need to talk a bit about the settlements themselves. People see them as a big obstacle to peace, but the truth of the matter is that the settlements are only 1.7% of the disputed land that we're talking about, and it's such an irrelevant and small issue that I think is it shows how much they don't understand what really is going on and how much it's not relevant to the issue. It won't solve anything. It will only hurt the relationships between Israel and the United States. And what's important to say on that matter is that I really see Israel as the front line and not dealing with the real issue, which is radical Islam, nuclear Iran, which are much more worrying and much more important, just means that they don't understand that Israel is the front line, and at some point it will reach the United States and Europe, too.
Lieutenant Aviv Regev of the Israel Defense Forces, its distinguished 101st Paratrooper Brigade, in which he serves as a deputy platoon commander. Good luck with the film and with helping bring this very important message to the American people. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your service. Next up, Michelle Van Cleve joins us. We'll talk about the torture report and counterintelligence reform in the United States. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama promised to fundamentally transform the United States of America. The most alarming of these transformations may be his switching sides in what used to be called the War on Terror. Thanks to Team Obama, we are increasingly aligned with, supportive of, and enabling those most aggressively threatening freedom-loving people like us. A prime example of how wrong-headed and dangerous this transformation is can be found in recent reports that Mr. Obama is considering imposing sanctions on Israel over its construction of so-called settlements. Yet, he has simultaneously been dismantling the sanctions regime on Iran, the nation in the region that is our most dangerous enemy and Israel's. By clearly signaling that he does not have Israel's back, President Obama is inviting the next and possibly cataclysmic war against our ally and us. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Last week, Secretary of Defense Hagel announced that an additional 1,000 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan through the spring of 2015. Although this announcement came after 2 weeks of intense Taliban attacks, Obama officials claim it was only because the U.S. has not obtained enough troop commitments from other NATO states. The administration also contends that this does not represent a change in the president's plan to cut the number of U.S. troops by half next year and to leave only a couple hundred by the end of 2016. I believe this decision is due to both a shortage of allied troop contributions as well as an increase in Taliban attacks. But it could also indicate that the president is rethinking his troop withdrawal plan for Afghanistan in light of its widely criticized strategy to pull all U.S. troops out of Iraq and the prospect that the Taliban may overrun Afghanistan after coalition troops withdraw. This is Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I am thrilled to say, joined by a friend and colleague, a much admired colleague at that, of many, many years. Her name is Michelle Van Cleave, and she has served our government in numerous capacities, both in the legislative branch and in the executive branch. She most prominently served as the National Counterintelligence Executive for President George W. Bush from 2003 to 2006. She is currently a driving force behind a relatively new institution in Washington, D.C., the Jack Kemp Foundation, and directs its Kemp Legacy Project. Michelle Van Cleave, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's good to be with you this morning, and thank you for all you do for the country.
Oh, well, it's a mutual admiration society, needless to say. Let me just ask, because it is on the front pages of every paper in the country and getting 24/7 coverage, your thoughts as an intelligence professional in a previous life or two, what do you make of the so-called torture report out of the United States Senate's Intelligence Committee's majority, let me emphasize, majority staff?
I thought it was an unfortunate decision on the part of the chairman of the committee to release that very one-sided and selectively written report. It was a blow to America, to the CIA, to be sure, but to all of us, because it was written in such a partisan and damning way, and not following genuine, fair, analytic processes. You know, Frank, they wrote that report, which purported to criticize CIA's interrogation of high-value detainees, without ever once interviewing a single individual with CIA responsible for that program and for the product of that program. I just don't see how one can responsibly write a report with that methodology.
I guess I'd like to ask you, because you've been so steeped in the ways of Washington for so long, Michelle Van Cleave, to address sort of three different pieces of this, it seems to me. One, the merits of the case, what was actually found by the majority, from which the minority in the committee, by the way, dissented, from which the intelligence community has dissented, from which former directors and deputy directors of the agency have dissented. But talk a little bit, if you could, about kind of the merits of the findings, and then maybe about the process. You've addressed that a little bit, but you know what it means that we've got such a narrow report in terms of the authorship and support, and the repercussions of it. If you would touch on each of those.
Well, I of course haven't had the opportunity to read all 6,000 pages of the classified report, but I've certainly. I guess not, but I believe that the methodology, the approach here was to review some of the specific so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that were used to get at information that detainees might have, and then in turn to look at specific instances to inquire whether the intelligence derived thereby was of value to the United States. And I think, sadly, you know, reading the critiques and observations of others who've had the chance to read the entire report, to include the three past directors of CIA and deputy directors of CIA, all who joined together to criticize the report, that it was done in a way to work toward a predetermined end. And the predetermined end was to say none of this intelligence that was derived through the use of these techniques, all approved by the Department of Justice, by the way, were of value to the United States. And that simply does not comport with the facts as the CIA and the users of that derivative intelligence report them, that in fact some of this information was crucial to saving American lives.
The business of countering these jihadist threats most immediately, it is a challenge for intelligence broadly defined, but it is particularly a problem, I gather, for sort of counterintelligence as well, to discern what is being done inside our own country and the threats that we may be confronting. How important is it that we preserve and utilize techniques of interrogation, perhaps not in much application, the so-called enhanced techniques, but the practice of interrogation itself seems to have fallen of late into disuse at best and perhaps been dispensed with altogether?
Well, I am... I think that one can have differences of views on the extent to which enhanced interrogation can move forward before it crosses a line into morally reprehensible activities. And I think people of goodwill can reach different judgments about that based on the circumstances as well. And you have to remember where we were in the wake of September 11th and the horrible attack on this country and the need to get information very quickly. But even in those exigent circumstances, the techniques that were employed went through rigorous and repeated legal reviews before they were approved.
But I guess what I'm getting at, Michelle Van Cleave, is are we still in need, as an intelligence community, of being able to gather human intelligence through the practice of interrogation, whether it's, you know, with these more exotic practices or not, just the very business of in being able to interrogate, something that, as I say, I think the Obama administration has largely dispensed with.
Well, one cannot interrogate or question individuals that one does not have in hand. So once the and let me say there was certainly a change in approach when President Obama took office in pursuing terrorist operatives throughout the world. It changed from trying to acquire people in order to get at information, and then using, in many cases, these drone strikes simply preemptively to kill them. In that case, you don't have an opportunity to elicit more information, to gain more insight into their operations and their activities worldwide. But you make an excellent point that, you know, we do need, rely greatly upon human intelligence that we find from individuals, whether it's through, you know, in custody questioning or through the old techniques of just acquiring human intelligence. And that we look to CIA to do. And CIA is out there in the world, and many people in very dangerous circumstances trying to go after this information on behalf of keeping America safe. And we put them in impossible situations when a report like this gets released and includes, among other things, names and clues about who our operatives are and how they operate and where they may be operating, that enemies of the United States, intelligence organizations, foreign governments, as well as terrorist groups, will look at in granular detail to try to find these people and to defeat our purposes, America's purposes in the world.
Michelle Van Cleek, what are your thoughts about the announced decision of the Director of National Intelligence to merge the business you used to be in for the Bush administration, counterintelligence, with security?
Yes, just to make this distinction, the business I was in was going after spies rather than going after terrorists. I want to make that point. But the merger of that organization, which I led, with all the security responsibilities of the federal government is one that I fear will threaten to overwhelm the counterintelligence mission with the very voracious demands of security. You know, it's, if you forgive me for being a little esoteric, but these missions of security and counterintelligence, while complementary, are also sometimes in conflict in the way that they're run, because security requires, you know, gates and guards and protective measures that cuts off any interaction with a potential adversary as a way of protecting things, whereas counterintelligence, by its very nature, requires an engagement, a controlled engagement with the adversary to understand what he's doing and in order to be able to find ways to defeat what he's doing. So these things are in opposition.
Your leadership in that vein in the past has been deeply appreciated, as is the work that you're doing now at the Kemp Foundation. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, syndicated columnist Diana West joins us to talk about how Europe can be seen as a warning of what's in store for us at the hands of the jihadists. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, a syndicated columnist and best-selling author, a pundit extraordinaire. She is, among other things, brought to us the terrific book, American Betrayal: A Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can find her writings at dianawest.net, and you can catch her each week here at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back, Diana. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be back.
You know, you've been tracking closely and writing on and, in fact, reporting with friends of ours in Europe who are confronting in various ways a very palpable threat from enemies of freedom, most of whom, at least, make no secret of their desire to impose the Islamic supremacist doctrine of Sharia over all of us. And I just wanted to talk with you quickly, Diane, about some examples of what's happening in Europe today and whether this might be headed our way as well. Let me start with reports out of Denmark that gangs are now enforcing Sharia law in parts of that country. Again, this has been building for some time, but the Nordic countries aren't where you'd exactly think you'd be confronting this problem. But it seems that we are. What's happening there?
Well, this has been happening for a long time, and now we are seeing a ramping up of the blatant enforcement of Sharia norms in Danish neighborhoods where they can be by using street gangs to essentially run the old-fashioned protection rackets. You know, you do it our way or else. And this is a reality. This is just but one example of the flexing of Islam really in Europe as we see Sharia being implemented. And I think that in terms of whether we will see this here, I think it's really important to understand we're looking at very tiny Islamic populations in European countries. They are a larger percentage than they are in the United States. And yet, and these countries, of course, are smaller. So we're looking at a more concentrated presence of everyone in the country. But we're looking at something like 2% of the Danish population, 3%, 3.5% of the British population. I mean, these are very small percentages. And so what they do tell us is that the proponents of Sharia, the people who really want to see an Islamic republic in every single nation in the world, they are given cover and power by very small percentages, very small Islamic blocs.
It's a critically important point because it really does impress upon all of us how this happens, even with the numbers of people perpetrating these kinds of crimes or assaults on our Western civilization being tiny. Diana, let me turn to another Nordic country with another particularly egregious practice taking place there. Again, I think in the nature of this effort to force the native population to submit, and that is the practice of rape by these jihadists. What do we know about how that's manifesting itself, both in Sweden and I think probably elsewhere in Europe as well, but particularly in Sweden at the moment?
Again, you can track this with the incursions of, or the presence, or the entry of Islamic demographics into countries like Sweden. Sweden has seen a skyrocketing of rape with a skyrocketing of Islamic immigration. I mean, the numbers track very, very closely. And this becomes a tool. We see this in war-torn countries like Congo or something, where rape is used as a tool to make a population terrorized. I mean, it is the most brutal kind of act of conquest, and we are seeing that in Sweden. We've been seeing it for some time. It is something that people don't want to talk about. They don't want to attach it to the prevalence among the Islamic men that are in their country.
Diana, moving right along, because there are several other pieces of this that I want to just ask you to touch on. In France, there are now, by latest estimate I have, something on the order of 780 no-go zones, as they're called, that are formally recognized by the government of France as places that the authorities of the country may not enter as a practical matter. They're being subjected, these areas, predominantly Muslim, of course, to Sharia despite the violation of the laws of the land. Is this a unique phenomenon in France, or are we seeing it elsewhere as well?
Oh, we're seeing it all over Europe. The French may codify it in a way that we have more easier access to, but no, this is prevalent in all the European nations. Speaking of Sweden, you have pretty much the city of Malmo under some kind of Islamic jurisdiction. This is what happens. This is how the enclaves are carved out. This is how the Sharia zones are established. First, it's de facto. We look at England. Now we see, de jure. We see acceptance of Sharia in many legal instances, Sharia courts.
No, I was going to come to that. We actually have some 87, I think it is, Sharia courts that operate side by side with English common law. And we have a new book coming out momentarily from the Center on Sharia in American courts as well. But this is really, a sort of canary in the mineshaft. And Diana, you've been working closely with Lars Hedegaard and others in Europe who are not least Geert Wilders, the parliamentarian in the Netherlands, on the forefront of the fight for freedom of speech in these countries. Talk a little bit about what's happening on that front.
Well, this week, Geert Wilders, the parliamentary leader of the Party for Freedom, which is at this point, according to the polls, the number one party in the Netherlands, he was actually brought in for interrogation for a campaign speech that he gave in one of the last cycles, where he was discussing the prevalence of Moroccans, and he asked his people if they wanted more or less Moroccans, more or less freedom, more or less European Union, that kind of thing. And the concept of discussing more or less Moroccans brought him up into court. And the reason Moroccans
Not for the first time.
And Moroccans are a very important thing to discuss in the Netherlands because the prevalence of crime in that particular population exceeds, you know, all others. This is a real problem. And when you're trying to control your borders, which is something that Geert Wilders presses as absolutely the answer, or the certainly the starting point of trying to reclaim Netherlands and to preserve the identity of Netherlands so it does not become an Islamic country, controlling your borders becomes the only means to really do this in any kind of effective way. And talking about the small numbers of Muslims in a population that can lead to Sharia norms, it becomes very important that immigration becomes really your leading tool. It isn't so much about dropping bombs on pickup trucks thousands of miles away in a mountaintop. It's about controlling who comes into your country to live and establish a new way of life that, yes, is antithetical to everything that has developed there constitutionally, religiously, and culturally.
This is the jihad, really, that's taking place at home in these countries, the Hijra, you know, jihad through immigration. And again, it brings us to our own circumstance, Diana West, syndicated columnist, dianawest.net. We've got a very similar set of phenomena. They're not as far advanced. The population numbers may not be as substantial in a much larger country like ours. But yet, is it an exaggeration to say this is what's coming here if these Sharia-adherent Muslims have their way?
Oh, I think it's absolutely no exaggeration. I think it's an understatement. I think that the predicament we find ourselves in is that so few people, you accepted, but so few people, and certainly in the media where it's absolutely essential, and certainly in the political sphere where it's even more essential because that's where the power is, will not discuss these things, will not face them. There is almost a clamp on their mouths, which even though we have a First Amendment, it's really shocking and I think in any way shameful. In Europe, they do not have a First Amendment. Geert Wilders himself can be dragged off to court for saying things that this would not happen in the United States. And yet, our lawmakers, our media, tend to keep their mouths shut, and they just want it to go away.
Yeah, we've had the former Secretary of State and putative Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton talking about using old-fashioned techniques of shaming and peer pressure to essentially, circumvent or abrogate, really, the First Amendment here. Diana West, what you do is so important. Thank you for notably your columns each week, but also, of course, your wonderful book, American Betrayal. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.